When he was on the drift point of sleep, Guirin began to recite in a dark murmur under his breath. He spoke slowly, feeling each word of his song of the past, a gift from his Agwin, the gate to the right.
I was a flame, flaring in the fire. I was a hare, hiding in the briar. I was a drop, running with the rain. I was a scythe, slicing the grain. Axe and tree, ship and sea, naught that lives is strange to me. I was a beggar, pleading a meal. I was a Dwayoma sword of steel.
At those words he saw her, the Agwin, the white lady, with her pale face, lips red as rowan berries, and raven dark hair. He was never sure where he saw her, whether it was in his mind or out in a dark place of the world, but he saw her as clearly as the temple ceiling. Then more vividly than the ceiling, she was smiling as she ran her fingers through her hair and beckoned to him. The candle-thrown shadows turned to moonlight and fell, wispy white, to envelop him. He heard his own voice chanting, but the words were meaningless. The last thing he saw was the priest, leaning close to catch every whisper. Guirin was walking to the wellhead by the white birches, a little patch of grassy ground, three slender trees, the grey stone wall of the well, all were as clear and solid to him as the temple. But on every side stretched an opalescent white void, torn by strange mists. The Agwin perched on the edge of the well and considered him with a small, cruel smile.
"Are you still my faithful servant?" she said.
"I am your slave, my lady. I live and die by your whim."
She seemed pleased, but it was always hard to tell, because instead of eyes she had two soft spheres of the opalescent mist.
"What do you want of me?"
"The rain refuses to fall in our land. Can you show me why?"
"And what would I have to do with rain?"
"You are the wise one, shining in the night, the heart of power, the golden light, my only love, my true delight."
She smiled, less cruel, and turned to stare down into the well. Guirin heard a soft lap and splash of water, as if the well opened into a vast dream river.
"There was a murder," she said, "but no curse. It was properly avenged. Ask him yourself."
She disappeared, leaving the birches rustling behind her. Guirin waited, staring into the shifting white mist, tinged here and there with rainbow-like mother-of-pearl. A man was walking out in the mist, wandering half-seen like a ship off a foggy coast. When Guirin called to him, he came. A young warrior, sandy-haired, with humorous blue eyes, and smiling just as if his chest weren't sliced open with a sword cut. Endlessly, blood welled and gouted down his chest to vanish before it tripped to his feet. The vision was so clear that Guirin cried out. The warrior looked at him with his terrifying smile.
"What land are you from, my friend?" Guirin said. "Are you at rest?"
"The land of the Boers bore me and buried me. I rest because my brother cut my killer's head from his shoulders."
"And was that vengeance enough?"
"Was it? Ask yourself, was it?"
The spectre began to laugh.
"Was it?"
"It should have been, truly."
The spectre howled with laughter. As if his sobbing chuckle brought the wind, the mist began to swirl and close in over the birch trees.
"Who are you?" Guirin said. "Don't you remember? Don't you remember that name?"
The laughter went on and on, as, no longer solid, the spectre whirled, a flickering shadow in the closing mists, a red stain dripping on white, then gone. There was only the mist and the soft rustle of wind. From out of the mist came the voice of his Agwin.
"He was avenged. Take warning."
As her voice faded, the mist turned thick, swirling, damp and cold, wrapping Guirin round, smothering him, pushing him this way and that like a wind-blown leaf. He felt himself running, then slipping, falling a long way down. The shadows were dark on the ceiling of the temple. Obin sighed, stretching his back, and leaned closer.
"Are you back? It's 2 hours before dawn."
Shaking with cold, his stomach knotted with fear, Gwyrin sat up and tried to speak. The temple danced around him. Obin caught his hands hard.
"For the love of Bel," Gwyrin whispered. "Get me some water."
Obin clapped his hands together twice. Two young priests hurried in carrying wooden bowls. Obin draped his cloak around Gwyrin's shoulders, then helped him drink, first water, then milk sweetened with honey. The taste of food brought Gwyrin back to the world better than any act of will could have done.
"Bring him some bread as well."
Gwyrin wolfed down the bread, washed it down with long, greedy swallows of milk, until he suddenly remembered he was gobbling in the middle of a temple.
"My apologies, but it takes me this way."
"No apology needed," Obin said. "Do you remember the vision?"
The blood-gushing spectre rose again in Gwyrin's mind.
"I do. How do you read it?"
"It was a true murder, sure enough. It happened when I was a tiny lad, so I remember summat of it. You saw Lord... oh, was it Carol? I can't remember. But the head of the Boar clan he was, cruelly murdered by the Falcons. But truly, just as your white lady said, it was avenged, twice over, some would say. The gods had justice, and I see no reason for Great Bel to be displeased."
"Well then, there's no curse on the land, because that's all my lady could show me."
"Just so. We will perform the horse sacrifice at the waning of the moon."
Until the sun rose, Gwyrin rested at the temple. He was so tired he was yawning, but sleep refused to come to him. His mind raced, reproducing bits of the vision, or seeing flecks of the white mist, then simply babbling to itself. The ritual always left him this way. Though some bards develop a lust for the strange white lands and the marvels therein, a madness that eventually takes over their minds, Gwyrin felt mostly disgust, based on a healthy fear of losing himself forever in the swirling mist. Yet as he thought it over, this particular vision seemed to have a message for him. He knew that murdered lord, knew him like a brother.
"Was it vengeance enough?" he thought. "Truly it should have been."
When the sun came in pale shafts through the temple windows, he shook off these incomprehensible thoughts and went to fetch his horse for the ride home. Gwyrin slept all morning, or rather he tried to sleep. It seemed that someone was always coming in, one of the children chased away by the maidservant, or Lisa, fetching a bit of her sewing, a page sent by the lord to make sure the bard was resting. Finally, the maidservant, Katha, who seemed more than usually dim-witted that morning, crept in to find a clean pair of brigger for one of the lads. When Gwyrin sat up and swore at her, she cowered back, snivelling, her big blue eyes filling with tears. She was, after all, only 15.
By the gods, I'm sorry, Gwyrin said. Here, Katha, run and tell your mistress that her grouchy bear of a husband has given up trying to hibernate. Go fetch me bread and ale, will you?
Katha beat a hasty retreat with an awkward curtsy. She had no time to shut the door before the boys raced in, shouting da, 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 and scrambling up on the bed to throw themselves at him. Gwyrin gave them each a hug and sat them down on the end of the bed. He was in no mood for a wrestling match. Adarin, just 7, was a skinny little lad with huge dark eyes and pale hair. Aiken, 2 and a 6 month, was chubby, always laughing, and always, or so it seemed, running around half-naked.
"Akern, where's your brigger?"
"Wet. He did that again, da,"
Adarin announced.
"Ah, ye gods. Well, I hope your mother wiped you off before you got on the bed."
"Of course, dearest," Lisa said, strolling in. "If you hadn't been so mean to Katha, she would have had the lad dressed by now." Gwyrin nodded in a meek admission of guilt. Pieces of his dreams and of his vision were floating in his mind. He wanted to compose a song about them. He could almost feel the words in his mouth. Lisa sat down next to him, the whole family settling in.
"What's wrong with Katha anyway?" Gwyrin said. "She's so cursed touchy these days."
"Oh, she's got a man on her mind, and not much of a man at that."
"Indeed? Who?"
Lisa looked significantly at Adarin, whose little ears grew bigger every day, and changed the subject. As soon as he'd eaten, Gwerin went out alone for a long walk through the fields. He wandered vaguely, hardly aware of where he was, stumbling occasionally in the long grass as he worked out his song. He would sing snatches of it aloud, changing the words around, working over every line until it was perfect. A stanza at a time, he memorized it, linking it together in his mind with chaining images and alliteration. He would never write it down. If a bard learned to read, learn so much as the names of the letters, his Agwin would desert him. Without her, he could never compose a song again. His mind finally at rest, Gwerin came back to the dun just at twilight. In the cooler grey air, the servants and riders were sitting around in the ward, talking softly together and resting after the long hot day. As he walked toward the broch, Gwerin saw Cather perched on the edge of a horse trough and giggling up at one of the riders. Remembering Lisa's snide comment about Cather's man, Gwerin paused to look the lad over. Tall, blonde, good-looking in a rough sort of way, with the narrow blue eyes and high cheekbones of a southern man. Although Cather seemed besotted with him, the rider listened numbly and half-heartedly to her chatter. Surprising, because Cather was a beautiful girl, all soft curves and thick blonde hair. Although Gwerin would have preferred to ignore the matter, his wife was concerned, and for good reason. Riders were prone to getting serving lasses pregnant, and then doing their best to weasel out of marriage. Gwerin walked around the ward until he found Dorin, captain of the troop, who was sitting idly on a little bench and watching the twilight fade. Gwerin sat down beside him.
"Who's that new rider in the warband?" Gwerin said. "A southern lad, and my wife's lass is making a fool of herself over him."
Dorin grinned in easy understanding.
"Name's Tannic. He rode in here a while back, and our lordship took him on. He's a good man with his sword, and that's all that should count, truly."
"Should?" Gwerin raised an eyebrow.
"Well, now, he's an odd lad."
Dorin considered, struggling with this unfamiliar kind of thought.
"Keeps to himself, and then he's dead quiet when he fights. When we rode that raid on Lord Kenneth's cattle, Tanno was as quiet in the scrap. Creeps a man's flesh to see someone make his kill without even a cursed war cry."
The mention of the cattle raid reminded Gwerin that he had yet to sing about it. Although songs about raids were his least favourite, this one deserved the honour as part of the new feud between the Wolf Clan and Lord Kenneth's boars to the north.
"I don't suppose this Tanno's thinking of honourable marriage and such like," Gwerin said.
"Ah, by the hells, keep little Cather away from him if you can. He flies alone, Tannic. One of the lads started calling him the Falcon, you see, just as a jest, but it stuck. I was sure there'd be trouble over it, but Tanno just smiles and says the name suits him well enough."
"Well, here, Cather's mother is a good sort, and she trusted her daughter to my care. If you want to do a bard a favour, have a word with this Falcon, will you? Tell him to course for another field mouse."
"What man wouldn't do a bard a favour? Done."
With this tedious matter disposed of, Gwerin went back to the tower. His mind was running to thoughts of cattle raids. He could piece a song easily out of bits of standard praise lines and other songs.
"Just mention everyone's name," he reminded himself. "None of these drunken louts know one song from another anyway."
Early in the morning, while it was still halfway cool, Tannic fetched his saddle, a rag and a bit of saddle soap from the tack room, and took them outside to a shady spot by the well. He drew himself a bucket of water, then sat down to clean his tack. Although some of the other riders were gathering in the tack room to do the same thing, he preferred to be alone, where it was quiet. He was always painfully aware that he was the new man in the warband, still on trial and working his way in. He was just working the soap up into a lather when Dorin came strolling over and hunkered down in front of him.
"Wanted a word with you, lad,"
Dorin said.
"Of course, Captain. Is there trouble?"
"Not yet, and there doesn't have to be. What do you think of the bard's little servant, lass? Our Gwerin doesn't like the way you've been hanging around her."
"She's hanging around me, Captain. She's a stupid little bitch as far as I'm concerned."
Dorin considered this in his slow way. Although he was telling the sincere truth, Tanik expected to be disbelieved, simply because no one ever trusted him.
"Surprised to hear you say that," Dorin said. "I was afraid you'd lean her down in the straw already. She seems to want it bad enough."
"What honour she has is safe from me. She gets on my nerves, babbles all the time."
"Well, a man could keep her too busy to talk."
"No doubt. You better if you want her."
With a shrug, Dorin got up, setting his hands on his hips and looking over the saddle.
"Well and good. Then you won't have any trouble doing what the bard wants and leaving her alone."
"None at all. I swear it."
Satisfied, Dorin walked off toward the barracks. Tanik went back to soaping his saddle leather.
"Do what the bard wants," he thought. "That stuffy little bastard of a nightingale, prattling all the time."
He was tempted to meddle with Cather just on the principle of the thing now, but he had already knocked his arrow for a more dangerous game. He worked slowly, taking his time and keeping a constant watch for the bard's woman. Usually she came down with her lads to let them see the horses. Tanik's patience was rewarded in a few minutes when Lisa came along with the boys. As they went into the stable, Tanik sat back on his heels and watched her. There was just something about Lisa, a soft sway of her hips when she walked, the way she had of smiling while she tossed her head, those eyes of hers that promised a very different kind of thing in bed than a scared young lass could offer. Watching her was as warm and pleasant as the sun on his back. He wondered if she were bored with her stuffy older man.
"What the bard wants, indeed," Tanik thought. "We'll just see about that."
At noon, Tanik made a point of watching Lisa as she ate with her husband. The bard and his family, the chamberlain and his, had a privileged table next to Lord Marowick's by the Hearth of Honour. Tanik took a place at one of the riders' tables where he could see her easily. While she ate, Lisa seemed far more concerned with her children than her husband, who seemed lost in one of his usual fogs somewhere, idly nibbling bread and looking across the room. It was such a good sign that Tanik began considering ways to get a word alone with Lisa. One of the other riders elbowed him in the ribs.
"What's all this?" Genin said. "Looks to me like you're watching a doe in someone else's woods, my friend."
"What's the danger in hunting a doe when the stag doesn't have horns?"
"The stag doesn't need horns when there's a keeper to watch out for poachers. Lord Marowick would turn you out if you stuck your thumb in the bard's ale."
"Indeed?"
Tanik turned to give him a slow stare.
"Are you going to run to the captain with the tale?"
Genin cringed in a satisfying way and shook his head no, but Tanik paid strict attention to his food. There was no use in giving the game away. If he wanted Lisa, he was going to have to fight to get her, but then he was used to fighting for everything he wanted.
"Nothing in my whole cursed life ever came easy," he thought. "No reason for it to start now."
Late on a drowsy hot day, Nevin rode into Lord Marriott's village of Bleathbeer. It wasn't much of a place, a handful of houses, a blacksmith's forge, not even a proper tavern, a problem, since he was going to have to find somewhere to stay. He'd come to banish the unnatural drought, but such major Dwayoma workings took time. Camping out in the forest, though possible, would be wearisome. After 50 years of travelling the roads as a herbman, he was old, stiff, easily tired, and at heart, sick of his constant solitude. Round the village well stood 3 women, holding their water buckets while they gossiped. When Nevin led his pack mule and horse over, they smiled and greeted him with the aching curiosity of the perennially bored. At the news that he was a herbman, the smiles grew even broader.
"Now that's a welcome thing," one woman said. "Will you be staying long, good sir?"
"I was thinking of it. I need to search the woods and fields for more herbs, you see. Do you know of anyone who'd take in a lodger? I can pay, of course."
The 3 women thought hard, running over their own domestic arrangements aloud, and finally reaching the reluctant conclusion that they had no room.
"Now there's Banner," one of them said. She's got that little hut in the back of her house.
She'll talk the poor man's ear off, said another.
But who else has a hut? Said the first.
When the conclusion was reached that no one else did, Nevin got directions to the farm where Banner, a widow, lived with her only son. Nevin found the farmstead about a mile down the road, a big enclosure behind a low, packed earth wall. Since the gate was open, he led his horse and mule inside and looked round. In the muddy yard stood a big stone round house, a cow barn, various sheds for chickens and such like, and off to one side a shabby wooden hut in the shade of a poplar tree. When Nevin called out a halloo, a young sandy-haired man hurried out of the cow barn with a rake in his hands.
"Good morrow. Are you Coville?" Nevin said. "The villagers told me you and your mother might take in a paying lodger. I'm a travelling herbman, you see."
"Ah!"
Coville leaned on the rake, looked Nevin over, turned his attention to the horse and mule, considered Nevin a bit more, then nodded.
"Might. Depends on what Mam says."
"I see. Can I speak to your mother?"
Coville considered for a long, slow moment.
"In a bit. She's out picking berries."
Coville turned and walked back to the barn. Nevin sat down on the ground by the wall and waited, watching flies drift in air scented with cow. He was just making up his mind that he'd be better off in the forest when a stout woman, with wisps of grey hair peeking under her widow's black headscarf, came hurrying in. Behind her a beautiful blonde lass, too nicely dressed to be living on the farm, led a small skinny lad with the biggest eyes Nevin had ever seen. All of them carried wooden buckets, and the lad's mouth was a predictable purple stain. Nevin bowed to the widow and ran through his tale once again.
"An herbman, good sir," Banner said. "Well, the gall of my son for making you wait out here. He should have had the decency of offering you a bit of ale. Come in, come in."
Inside the house it was cooler, but the flies still drifted and the scent was just as strong. The big half-round of the main room was scattered with straw, a few pieces of much-repaired furniture, sacks of oats and farm tools. The forest began to look better and better. Banner, the lass, and the child put their buckets onto a wobbly table. When the lad reached for more berries, the lass caught his hand.
"That's enough for Darren," she said. "You'll get a stomach ache, and we've got to go back soon." "I want to stay and talk to the herbman." "Maybe another day." "But he'll be gone another day."
Nevin started to make some trivial remark, but the words froze in his mouth as he glanced at the lass and recognized the soul looking out from her eyes.
"Isola, by the gods."
"Well, good sir," Aderin said. "Won't you be gone?"
"Oh, I doubt it."
Nevin hurriedly collected his wits.
"I'm just here to ask good Banner if she'll let me stay in her hut."
"Oh, I'm sure we can work something out," Banner said. "A bit of coin will be welcome. So here, Addo, the next time Cather brings you to visit, you can talk to the herbman."
While Banner was showing him the hut, she was more than glad to tell Nevin about Cather, her youngest daughter, who had gotten herself a good place up in Lord Marriott's Dun as the servant for the bard's woman. Banner also made it quite clear that Aderin was the son of the bard and his wife. She repeated it several times, lest Nevin think her daughter had a bastard. The hut itself was small, with a packed earth floor, a tiny hearth, and one narrow window with a cowhide drape for want of proper shutters. Nevin decided it would have to do. While he unpacked his goods from his horse and mule, Banner swept the dust out of the hut and covered the floor with fresh straw. After he shooed Banner out, he spread his bedroll in the curve of the wall, arranged his canvas packs of herbs opposite, and dumped his saddlebags and cooking pots by the hearth. He sat down in the middle of the floor and looked over his new home, such as it was.
"So, Isola's here," Nevin thought, "or rather, Cather. I mustn't make that mistake."
She was the first sign he'd had in 50 years that he might be drawing close to the soul who'd once been Bronwyn of the Falcon. Since his youth he'd looked constantly for her to be reborn as he wandered the kingdom, with only the chance that is more than chance to guide him. although he'd been expecting her to come back immediately so that when she, in her new body, was about 15, he'd be only 36, young enough to marry her, the Lords of Weird had chosen otherwise, with their usual contempt for a man's vanity. He had never found her. Though he was growing weary with age, he felt no signs of sickness, no omens of approaching death. At his level of the Dwayoma, he should have been able to foretell his death by now, in order to make the proper plans for leaving life, but he saw nothing. The Lords of Weird had accepted his rash vow literally. He would never rest until he found her and set things right.
Isola had a hand in the tragedy, Nevin remarked to the fireplace. It's just possible that the Lords of Weird would bring them together again.
The fireplace stared back in silence, which Nevin took as doubt. It would still be worth taking a look around while he worked on banishing the drought. He could simply announce his presence as a herbman and get himself invited to visit Lord Mariac's dun. Oddly enough, it was the bard's son who provided Nevin with an even easier entry to the dun. The very next day, Aderyn came down to see him. Nevin was honestly surprised, because he'd assumed that the lad's interest was only a childish curiosity.
"Do you mind if I see the herbs and things?" Aderyn said. "Am I in the way? Dar says I'm always in the way."
"Not in the way at all. Maybe you can help me, in fact. Are there any ruined or abandoned farms around here? Certain kinds of herbs grow in land that's been allowed to go fallow, you see, and those are the kind of herbs I need to pick."
"There's one, truly. There was this farm, and Lord Kenneth of the Boar said it was his, but our lord said it was his, and so they fought over it. So the farmer got scared and just left, and now there isn't anyone there to fight over."
"Oh, ye gods! Well, that's a pack of noble-born warriors for you."
"Don't you like riders and battles and stuff?"
"Not truly, but I suppose you do. Lads usually do."
"I don't."
Aderyn wrinkled up his nose.
"I'll never be a rider when I grow up. It's just being cattle thieves. I don't care what anyone says."
In surprise, Nevin considered the lad. Aderyn twisted one foot behind the other, balanced precariously, and looked wide-eyed around the hut.
"Well, here," Nevin said. "Would you like to show me where this farm is and help pick herbs? We'll have to go tell your mother where we're going first."
"Oh, I would. There's never anything to do up in the fort. Let's go ask Mam."
Nevin got a cloth sack, some clean rags to wrap herbs in, and his small silver sickle. With Aderyn chattering all the way, they went up to the dun. As soon as they came through the gates, Cather ran over and grabbed Aderyn's arm.
"Where have you been?" Cather said. "I've been worried sick." "I just went down to see the herbman. Where's Mam? I've got to ask her if I can go for a walk." "She's waiting upon Lady Cabrilla, but your da's in the great hall."
Cather glanced at Nevin.
"Shall I tell our lord's lady that you're in the village, sir? I'll wager she'd like a look at your herbs."
"I'd be most grateful if you would."
Nevin made her a bow.
"Tell her I have perfumes and hair rinses and such like, as well as medicine."
Although Cather's eyes lit up at the thought, Aderyn grabbed Nevin's shirt and dragged him firmly off to the great hall, where Gwerin the bard was drinking at Lord Mariac's table. A solid-looking man in his 30s, with blonde hair and a long blonde moustache, Gwerin rose to greet his son and this stranger. Nevin got his second shock in as many days. Blaine. All at once Nevin wondered about Aderyn's mother.
"Oh, ye gods," he thought, "Bronwyn can't be married to another man."
But even as he thought it, he had the uneasy feeling that the Lords of Weird were laughing at him. While Aderyn chatted out his request, Gwerin listened with a pleasant smile.
"Very well," he said, "if it's truly all right with you, good sir." "It is. Your son's remarkably bright, good bard. I always enjoy teaching someone a bit about herbs."
After a pleasant afternoon gathering yellow dock, feverfew, and mallow in the abandoned fields, Nevin took Aderyn back to the dun, then returned to his hut. He trimmed up the plants, cut off the useless parts, and laid the leaves and stalks out carefully on clean cloth to begin drying. As he worked, his mind ran restlessly of its own accord. Blaine and Isola here together. He had never expected to see the other actors in his and Bronwyn's tragedy again. It was ominous, troubling, making him wonder if his burden of weird was heavier than he'd ever dreamt.
So many lives were ruined along with hers, he thought, and all because of me and Geraint.
He decided that tomorrow he'd take his wares up to the dun and get a look at this bard's woman. Until then, he put the matter firmly out of his mind. He had other work to do. Just at sunset, Nevin left the farm and went down to the river bank, where he found an ash tree and sat down under its spreading branches to watch the river. A sluggish, sullen flow, bloody tinged in the last of the sunset, the river was weak even on the inner plains. Using the second sight, Nevin could see how its raw elemental force ran tangled, permeating, interpenetrating, and surrounding the world men call real are other worlds, or states of being, or even forces, if you would call them that. The Dwayoma calls them planes, knows their dwellers, studies their forces, and has ways to see them, and to know that they're as real as the only world most people can see. That the human mind is the gate between the planes is a safe secret to tell, because it takes years of study and work before the gate will open, years that impatient fools won't spend to learn secrets they shouldn't have. One of these planes, the etheric, is the root of the elementals, what men call the wild folk, the source of natural forces, and the web that holds every living creature's soul. Within or beyond that plane is a locus of force that the Dwayoma terms the wildlands, and more of the human mind is rooted there than people would like to admit. To see what was troubling the river, Nevin built himself a gate to the wildlands. He let his breathing slow until he felt rooted to the earth. The air flowed in and out of his lungs. Before him was the water, with the last fire of the sun glinting upon it. His mind was the fifth element, reconciling the four. Slowly, carefully, he built up in his mind an image, a pale blue glowing five-pointed star, its single point upright as is holy. After all his long years of work, it took little effort to make the star flame and live apart from his will. He moved the image out of his mind until it seemed to stand flaming on the river bank. Inside this traced sigil, he could see the wildlands opening out blue and misty under a cool sun. He was about to project himself through when the wild folk came to him, rushing through the gate in a swirl of half-seen forms. Nevin felt the rushy tingle of power down his spine as they swept around him and projected raw emotions, trouble, hatred, and pleading with him to help them. The wild folk of air cursed those of fire and water alike, while those of earth were in despair.
"Here, here," Nevin said. "I'll have to speak to your kings. There's nothing I can do alone."
They were gone, racing back to their lands. Although Nevin considered following, he decided that it would be best to let them bring the message to the kings first. Slowly, he erased the pentacle, drawing the blue light back into himself, then slapped his hand thrice on the earth to end the operation. In the cool night air, he felt strong and at peace.
"I'll try again tomorrow night," Nevin thought. "If things are this bad, sooner or later the kings will accept my aid."
Although man is meant to rule the wild folk, not worship or placate them, they deserve respect and due courtesy, which Nevin could offer them as one prince true-born to another. But it would have to be soon if he was going to spare the people of Bleithbeer a famine. If this drought continued much longer, the crops would be past saving. Early on the morrow, when the day was still cool, Nevin returned to the Lord's Dun to lay his wares before Lady Cabrilla. She received him in the women's hall, where her serving women and the maidservants were gathered to see what this travelling peddler had to offer. As he laid out packets of herbs, pomanders, and cosmetic preparations on a table, Nevin surreptitiously studied each woman in turn. He was just giving up hope when a young matron, her raven dark hair caught up in an embroidered headscarf, came slipping in a side door and stood on the edge of the crowd. For all her different features and colouring, Nevin could think of her as no one but his Bronwyn.
"There's our Lisa," Lady Cabrilla said comfortably. "Nevin, this is the bard's wife."
Nevin wondered why he'd ever been so stupid as to think his weird would work out cleanly. He bowed over Lisa's hand and mumbled some pleasantry, which she returned. As their eyes met, she recognized him. He could see it in a sudden flash of joy in her dark blue eyes, then a bewilderment, as she doubtless wondered why she was so pleased to see this old man. That flash of joy was so much more than Nevin had believed possible, that for the joy of seeing her again, he was willing to endure the harshest of weirds. The horse sacrifice took place out in the sacred oak grove at the edge of the village. On the appointed day, just before sunset, the villagers and the lord's household formed a ragged procession by the village well. Lord Marowick knelt before Obin, the high priest, and handed over the reins of a splendid white stallion. While Obin held the horse, the young priests decorated the bridle with mistletoe. When they began to chant, the horse tossed its head and snorted, feeling its strange weird like a rider on its back. To the slow pace of the chanting, Obin led the horse away. Lord Marowick scrambled up and fell in behind, with the rest of the crowd following him. The procession wound through the grove, filled with long pillars of golden sunlight, and came to the altar deep within. Unlike that in the temple, this altar was a rough slab of barely worked stone. Wood for a large fire lay ready upon it. While Obin held the horse, the young priests came forward, struck flint on steel, and lit the kindling. Obin watched, narrow-eyed. If the fire caught poorly, the day was cursed, and the sacrifice would have to be postponed. As the flames danced up bright and strong, the crowd sank to its knees. Gwerin took the chance to move well back to the edge. Since he had a Darren with him, he wanted to be a good distance away when the horse met its weird. As the chanting droned on, a Darren twisted round to look over the crowd. Men on one side, women and tiny children on the other, everyone who lived within 20 miles was here to beg the god to spare their crops. When Gwerin looked over the women, he saw Lisa and Cather well to the back, Cather with a scarf ready to hide her eyes. Akern was asleep in his mother's lap. The chanting grew faster and louder as the flames rose high.
"Da," a Darren whispered, "this is a waste of a good horse."
"Hush, don't talk at rituals."
"But nothing's going to happen till the full moon."
When Gwerin threatened a slap, a Darren fell silent. A young priest took the nervous horse's reins from Obin, who stepped in front of the altar, raised his arms high into the air, and began to beg the god for mercy, his voice rising and quickening, faster and faster, until he cried out in a great sob of supplication. A priest blew on a brass horn, a rasping ancient cry down from the dawn time. Then silence. Obin took a bronze sickle from his belt and approached the horse, who tossed up its head in terror. When the brass horn blared, the horse pulled back, but the bronze sickle swung bright in the firelight. The horse screamed, staggering, blood gushing, and sank dying to its knees. Aderin began to sob aloud. Gwerin threw his arms around him, pulled him into his lap, and let the child bury his face against his father's shirt. He was wise to hide his eyes as the priests began dismembering the horse with long bronze knives. From his bard lore, Gwerin knew that in the dawn time, the victim would have been a man, and that this horse represented the god's growing mercy to his people. The knowledge would have been no comfort to his tender-hearted Aderin. The horns blew again as the priests worked, their arms bloody to the elbows. At last Obin cut a strip of bleeding meat and wrapped it in thick fat from the horse's thigh. With a long wailing chant, he laid the sacrifice in the midst of the flames. The fat sputtered and caught, flaring up with a smoky halo.
"Great Bell!" Obin cried. "Have mercy!"
"Have mercy!" the crowd sighed.
The young priest blew a great blare on the horn. The rite ended soon after. Since Aderin was weeping as if his heart would break, Gwerin picked him up and carried him as he looked desperately around for Lisa in the scattering crowd. Instead, he found Nevin, who was leaning against a tree and watching the flame-lit altar with a sour smile.
Oh, here, here, Addo, Nevin said, the smile disappearing. It's all over now. It's a pity, sure enough, but the poor beast is dead and beyond suffering.
They shouldn't have, Adarin sobbed. It won't even do any good.
It won't. But what's done is done, and you'd best not talk of it right here, where the people can hear you. They need to think it will help.
Slowly, Adarin sniffled himself to silence, wiping his face on his sleeve. Gwerin kissed him and set him down, taking his hand and drawing him close.
Well, Bard, Nevin said, do you think this will bring rain?
Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but either way the god will be pleased.
True spoken, and pious of you, truly.
The old man walked off, leaving Gwerin puzzled and more than a bit uneasy. As the crowd dispersed toward the village, Gwerin finally saw Lisa, hurrying to meet them. Just behind came Cather, with one of the riders who was carrying the still-sleeping Akern. When Gwerin recognized Tanak, he was annoyed. Here he told Doran to keep this young lout away from Cather. As he thought about it, he realized he'd seen a lot of Tanak lately, still hanging around the lass, sitting near her when she and Lisa were in the ward, or walking conveniently to meet them when she and Lisa were leaving the dun. That very next morning, Gwerin sought Dorin out when he came down into the great hall for breakfast. He waved the captain over to the side of the hall where they could be private, and put his complaint to him. Dorin looked honestly surprised.
"Well, curse the little bastard. I did talk to him, Gwerin, and here he managed to convince me he didn't give a pig's fart for Cather."
"There's nothing like lust to make a man lie. Here, I'll have a word with the lad myself later."
It was afternoon before Gwerin could get away from his lord's side long enough to go look for Tanak, but when he found him, he found Cather with him. Out in the ward, Tanak was grooming his horse while Cather stood beside him. She was telling him some long, complex tale about her elder sister, while Tanak listened with an occasional nod. As Gwerin strode over, Cather made him a hurried curtsy.
"I'm sure your lady wants you," Gwerin said.
With one last smile in Tanik's direction, Cather ran for the tower. Tanak looked up, the currycomb in his hand.
"My thanks," Tanak said. "By the hells, doesn't that lass ever hold her tongue?" "Every now and then. You can't find it as displeasing as that. You seem to seek out her company whenever you can."
Tanak looked at him with a barely concealed contempt.
"Maybe I do, maybe I don't. What's it to you?"
"Maybe nothing at all, as long as you fancy yourself as a married man some day. I warn you, if Cather ends up with child, I'm speaking to Lord Marowick about it. I don't care how many men in the warband you get to lie and swear they've had her too, she'll be your wife."
Tanik's hand tightened on the currycomb so hard that Gwerin was surprised the wood didn't crack. Rather than push things to a formal exchange of insults, Gwerin turned and walked away. If things ever came to a fight, doubtless Tanak could cut him to pieces with a sword. Tanak, of course, knew it too. When he told Lisa that he'd spoken to Tanak, she smiled, remarking that since she didn't care for the man, she'd be glad to have him stop turning up constantly at her servant's side. Over the next few days, Gwerin made a point of keeping his eye on the situation. At first, Tanak seemed to have taken the warning to heart, but the morning came when Gwerin saw Lisa, Cather, and the boys walking across the ward, and Tanak hurrying over to walk with them. Gwerin hurried downstairs and ran to catch up with them. At the first sight of him, Tanak made the women a hasty bow and went back to the barracks.
"Now ye gods, Cather,"
Gwerin snapped.
"Your mistress has spoken to you. I've spoken to you. Can't you get it through your pretty head that he's the wrong sort of man for you?"
Cather snivelled, grabbing her handkerchief from her kirtle and dabbing at her eyes. Lisa patted her gently on the arm.
"Gwerin's right," Lisa said. "Here, let's go up to the chamber where it's cool and have a nice talk."
"I want to walk with Dar," Adarin said. "Can I, Dar?"
"You may."
Gwerin held out his hand.
"We'll have a nice stroll, and let the women have their chat."
They walked down to the river, a trickle of water in mud, and sat down in the rustling dry grass. Without a breath of wind, the heat clung around them. Aderyn stretched out on his stomach in the grass and plucked a dead stalk to play with.
Dar, you don't like Tanik, do you?
I don't. Do you?
I don't. He scares me.
Well, the captain tells me he's a hard man.
Aderyn nodded, twisting the grass stalk into a loop.
You know what, Dar? He doesn't bother us to see Cather. When we walk, you know? He comes to see Mam.
Gwerin felt as if he'd been punched in the stomach. Aderyn tried to tie a knot in the slippery stalk, then gave up and started chewing on it.
Are you sure about that? Gwerin said.
I am. You told me to watch what people do, remember? So I was watching Tanik because I don't like him, and I wondered why I don't like him. I don't like the way he looks at Mam, and he always bows to her so nice, and he talks to Cather, but all the time he's looking at Mam.
Oh, is he now?
Aderyn started slitting the grass stalk with his fingernail and trying to braid the pieces. Gwerin looked at the sluggish river and felt his rage flaring, just as when a spark gets into dry grass. It creeps along, smokes, then flares to a sheet of flame racing along the meadowland.
That bastard, Gwerin thought, and does he think I'll back down without a fight over this?
Da, what's wrong? Don't look like that.
Oh, naught, lad. Just worrying about the cursed drought.
Don't. Nevin's going to fix it.
Gwerin forced out a smile. He had no time to worry about silly prattle about the herbman.
Let's get back to the dun. It's a bit hot out here, and there's a thing or two I want to keep my eye on.
What I want to know is this, Aderyn said. Why do herbs work on fevers and stuff?
Well now, Nevin said, that's a very long question to answer. Do you want to listen to a talk?
I do. This is all splendid.
They were kneeling on the floor of Nevin's hut and working with the herbs, turning them over to dry them evenly. Almost every day, Aderyn came down to help and study herbcraft. After his long loneliness, Nevin found the boy's chatter amusing.
Very well, Nevin went on. There are four humours, you see, in every human body. They match the four elements, fire, water, air, and earth. When all the humours are in perfect balance, then a person is healthy. Each herb has more or less of the various humours. They balance things out if someone is sick. If someone has a fever, then they have too much fiery humour. A febrifugal herb has lots of cool, watery humour and helps balance the fiery out.
Only four humours? I thought there should be five.
Nevin sat back on his heels in sheer surprise.
Well, so there are, but only four in the body. The fifth rules the others from the spirit.
Aderyn nodded, carefully memorising the law. More and more, Nevin was wondering if the lad was meant to be his new apprentice. The wondering made him weary. Since a Dwayoma man could have only one apprentice at a time, he could never take Aderyn on while bringing Bronwyn to the Dwayoma to fulfill his vow. At times, in the hope of seeing Lysa, Nevin would take Aderyn back to the dun on horseback. Often in the hot afternoons, the various members of the household would be sitting on the grassy hill. Since Nevin was now well known, one or the other of them would come over to ask him some medical question, or to buy a few herbs or such like. It was there that he met Tanik one afternoon, and saw his weird tangle around him like a fisherman's net round its prey. Leading the horse, Nevin and Aderyn were walking up the hill when Nevin noticed Cather sitting with one of the riders, a hard-eyed southern man. Aderyn noticed it too, and went skipping over.
"Cather, I'm going to tell Mam on you. You shouldn't be here with Tanik." "Hold your tongue, you little beast,"
Cather snapped.
"Won't. Won't, won't, won't. I'm going to tell."
Tanik got up, and something about the way he looked at Aderyn frightened Nevin, who made a point of hurrying over.
"Slapping a bard's son is a good way for a man to get his name satirized," Nevin remarked. "And what's it to you, old man?"
Tanik swung his head round. As their eyes met, Nevin recognized Geraint's soul in the arrogance blazing out of his eyes.
"You'd better not insult Nevin," Aderyn said. "He's Dwayoma."
Hold your tongue. I'm in no mood to listen to nonsense from a flea-bitten cub.
Tanik started to swing open-handed at the boy, but Nevin caught him by the wrist. The wild folk flocked to him and lent him so much raw strength that no matter how Tanik struggled, he couldn't break the herdman's grip. Nevin pulled him close, caught his gaze, and stared deep into his eyes while he let his hatred burn, and Wayoma lay behind it. Tanik went dead white and stopped struggling.
"I said, leave the lad alone," Nevin whispered.
Tanik nodded in terrified agreement. When Nevin released him, he turned and ran for the gates of the dun.
"Cather, take Addo back to his mother," Nevin said. "I'm going back to the farm."
All the actors in their grim little farce were there, even Geraint, face to face again in a way that Nevin had never foreseen. He realized that he'd fallen into a last vestige of royal pride, which values only the prince and princess and sees those around them only as supernumeraries. For the next few days, Nevin stayed away from the dun and his old enemy. But in the end, Lysa came to him, turning up at the farm one day with the plausible excuse that she'd come to fetch Aderyn home. Nevin sent the boy out on an errand and offered Lysa the only chair he had, a wobbly three-legged stool. She perched on it and looked idly around at the hanging bunches of drying herbs.
"The smell in here is so lovely. It's kind of you, sir, to be so patient with my Addo. You should hear him chatter about it at dinner. Today we learned about dog's tooth herb. Today we dried the comfrey roots. His father hardly knows what to think."
"Does it vex Gwyrin? Most men want their sons to show an interest in their own calling."
"Oh, it doesn't, because my man is the best-hearted man in the world. I think he's glad to see Aderyn taking such an interest in something."
"He's been a strange child from the moment he was born." Nevin smiled, quite sure of that.
"I'm surprised you don't have more children. You seem to love your lad so much."
"Well, I hope and pray to have more soon."
Lysa looked away, her eyes dark.
"I had a daughter, you see, between the two lads, but we lost her to a fever."
"I'm truly sorry. That's a hard thing for a woman to bear."
"It was."
Her voice went flat from remembered grief.
"Well, doubtless it was my weird, and my poor little Danagher's too."
Nevin felt a cold touch as he wondered if indeed it was her weird, since she drowned a child with her on that terrible night. So she had. The Dwayoma cold ran down his back as he realized who that child might have been if it had lived to be raised with himself and Hregar, a great master of Dwayoma indeed. Lysa smiled, looking out the door.
"Here comes our Aderyn now," she said.
Though she was only speaking casually, "our Aderyn," meaning only the Aderyn we both know, not some other Aderyn, her words turned Nevin cold to the heart.
"I swore I'd raise the child as my own," he thought. "A vow's a vow."
That night, Nevin went down to the ash tree by the river bank and sat down to watch the slow water run. As it came clear, his weird lay heavy on him. In this life, Bronwyn was gone from him. She would have to repay Blaine for the hopeless love of her that had led him to his death, and repay Aderyn, too, for cutting short his previous chance at life. Nevin owed Blaine and Aderyn a debt as well, since his scheming had left Bronwyn there with her brother's lust. Only once those debts had been repaid could he take her away for the Dwayoma. Yet Aderyn would be under his care for the next 20 years, because the Dwayoma is a slow craft to learn. In 20 years, Nevin was going to be over 90, and what if he had to wait for her to be reborn again? He would be well over 100, an unthinkable age, so old and dry that he would be helpless in a chair, like a thin stick or drooling babe, his body too old for the soul it carried, his mind a prisoner in a decaying lump of flesh. At that moment, Nevin panicked, shaking cold and sick, no longer a master of the Dwayoma, but an ordinary man, just as when a warrior vows to die in battle, but as the horns blow the charge, he sees death riding for him and weeps, sick of his vow when retreat is impossible. Around him, a tremor of night wind picked up cool, rustling the canopy of branches above him. Nevin rested his face in his hands and called on his trained will to stop himself from shaking.
"A vow's a vow," he told himself. "If I wither, then let me wither, so long as I fulfill that vow."
The wind stroked his hair like a friendly hand. He looked up, realizing that it was no natural wind, but the wild folk, sylph and sprite, half-seen forms and the flick of shining wings, a face showing here only to vanish there. They came to him as friends and felt his agony, clustering, sympathetic lives forming from the raw surge of elemental life. Nevin felt his weariness ebb away as they freely poured out some of their life to him, a gift between friends. He rose, walked forward, and stared up at the sky, where glittered a great white drift of stars, the snowy road, splendid, unreachable, but shining with promise. When he laughed aloud, his laugh was as full and clear as a lad's. He saw his weird open in front of him, maintained by his work in the wildlands. He would have life for the task, no matter how long it took as men measure time. It was that night that he learned this lesson. No one is ever given a weird too harsh to bear, as long as it is taken up willingly and fully, deep in the soul. At times, Lisa would leave Akern with Cather and walk to the farm to fetch Aderin back from the herbman. She liked these moments of solitude when she could walk alone, away from the busy press and chatter of her life among the women of the household. She also found herself drawn to old Nevin, for reasons she couldn't quite understand.
"Well, he's a wise, kind man who's travelled much," she would tell herself. "It's always interesting to meet someone new."
It was reason enough, of course, but at times she went to see him because she felt safe there, out of the fort and away from Tanik. She knew perfectly well that young rider was pursuing her, and lived in dread that her husband might notice. Lisa simply had too much to lose to be interested in adultery. A high social position, a good husband, wealth, comfort, and above all, her children. On an afternoon when the heat lay as palpable as a blanket over the land, Lisa left the dun earlier than usual and dawdled her way down the dusty road to the farm. About halfway along stood a copse of aspen trees, where she decided to rest for a few minutes. She walked into the parched shade, glanced round for a place to sit, and saw Tanik waiting for her. He stood as still as one of the trees, his head a little to one side, and he was smiling, looking her over with the sort of admiration a man gives to a beautiful horse in a market.
"What are you doing here?" she snapped.
"What do you think? I wanted a word with you."
"I've nothing to say. You'd best get back before the captain finds you gone."
When he stepped toward her, she drew back, her hand at her throat, her heart pounding.
"I've got to be on my way. My lad will come along soon enough if I'm not there to meet him."
This likely witness gave Tanik pause. Abruptly, Lisa realized that she was afraid he would rape her. For all his good looks, Tanik repelled her in a way that she couldn't understand, like seeing a dead animal rotting in the road. She knew the repulsion was daft. Rationally, she could admit that he was decent enough for a rider.
"May I walk with your ways, then?"
Tanik gave her a courteous bow.
"You can't!"
Lisa heard her voice rise to a scream.
"Leave me alone!"
She found herself running, racing out of the copse like a startled deer and running, running, running down the road until she was sobbing for breath and drenched with sweat. Half in tears, she spun around. But mercifully, he hadn't followed. That night, it was so hot that it took a long time to get the children to sleep. The boys tossed and turned and whined on top of the blankets, no matter how soothingly Lisa talked to them. Finally, Gwerin came in and sang them to sleep. Lisa went to their chamber, changed into a thin nightdress and lay down. In a bit, Gwerin joined her. He hung the candle-lantern up on the wall and sat down on the edge of the bed.
"Don't you have to return to our lord?"
Lisa said.
"I begged his leave. I need to talk with you."
In the shadowed light his eyes were cold, questioning. She sat up, feeling her hands shaking, and twisted a bit of her dress between her fingers.
"Here, my sweet," he went on. "You've been keeping dangerous company these days."
Oh, am I now? Who?
Tanik. Who else would I mean?
She clenched the cloth so hard that her fingers ached.
My lord, I swear to you that I want nothing to do with him. Do you doubt me?
Never. But I don't want my woman raped out in the stables.